somebody raised a question last time, and I want to pick up on this, and then we'll go ahead and, as I say, anytime you want to raise any comments or questions, please do. Now, why watch television at all? And amazingly, and I really mean this, that was my next point. Were you the one who raised the flag? And it really is, that's here it is. I mean, you know, I've got Owen, you know, part two right here on the top, and here it is, so you anticipated. Great minds running the same channel or something like that. All right. Where is it? Now, she argues that for a long time, she isn't opposed to cinema as such, or, you know, things on film rather than just in print. I mean, we have print media and we have film, or we have visual media. She isn't opposed as such to this, and she herself confesses to the fact that when she grew up, she was a tremendous movie nut, simply enchanted with the silver screen, Joan Crawford, and who were all Barbara Stanwyck and all the great ones. I don't know if after reading Dear Mommy or whatever it is, she'd still be enchanted with Joan Crawford any longer, but she really was hooked on movies. And some people do get hooked on movies. I had a friend of mine who had it worked out that he could catch, Shane Overholler had a movie at 7 o'clock on Friday night, and he could get up to the city, and if you go in before a certain time, you only have to pay a dollar. And he could catch two movies in the city, get a bus home, and then still pick up the 7 o'clock movies in Northfield in the evening. Some of you know Larry Christensen, it was from the Charismatic Movement, that's Larry's son, Tim, who was a real movie nut. So anyway, Owens was a real movie nut, and in a way resented the fact that television came along and preempted the movies, and have really, in a very real sense, replaced the movies as a source of entertainment and information and the rest in our life. And she asks the question, you know, why? And she sets it in historical context, and that's what I want to go through briefly here. Why television caught on more than the movies? Now, there's some very obvious reasons, obviously economic reasons. Once you buy the little box, you pay, what, $3.95 or whatever it is, or $400 or whatever. You've got something that's there, and assuming it isn't a lemon, you know, eventually you're going to be able to pay for it if you don't go to movies by way of compensation. Obviously, ease of access. You don't have to go out when it's 20 below, and like myself with 6 feet of snow in the driveway and a battery shed, one of the joys of living in the North Star State. And so on. It's simple, it's easy, it's always there. And she argues that a lot of people would say that's why television, in a sense, replaced the movies, but it really, she says, goes much beyond that. There are deeper reasons for it. And of course, it's a TV added dimension. It added instant real movie life. It's TV dealt with what was happening out in the world. And we're all familiar with seeing, you know, the portable instant cams or whatever they call them at all the movie events that go on, and all the public events that go on at us all the time. And TV didn't have to depend on fictionalized stories the way the movies do. And sometimes in stories, In movies, you would have to suspend belief or suspend your sort of rational facility because you knew what was happening up there wasn't really true. Like Gone with the Wind is supposed to be the best example. I suppose that dates me, but I see a lot of other people whose hair is the same color, so we all remember Gone. And then came back again, too. That's right. Sure, came back. And okay, anyway, we would have to suspend belief or disbelief, but somehow we believed it was true. But TV didn't have to depend on that, because TV dealt with what was really out there. And she feels that the historical context is enormously important here, especially TV caught on in the early 60s. For one thing, it had a very photogenic, attractive president, namely, of course, President Kennedy, who had a cast of hundreds of thousands around him. Cecil B. DeMille had to spend months, sometimes years, preparing for something like that. Kennedy could prepare something like that instantly. And all the, as we know, the interest was what we call media advisors in the White House. We have people who do nothing but stage, we call them media events, that we're all familiar with. Good example, when President Nixon returned from China, he waited in Alaska so that his timing for arrival at whatever, what's the field in Washington, the military? This one? Andrews, right. So that he would land exactly at prime time. He didn't have to. He could have stayed in Alaska. And Johnson did the same thing. I want to be bipartisan about this, because I'm going to be a Republican. Johnson arrived at Atlantic City, wasn't that where the Democratic Convention was in 1964, at exactly 6 o'clock, when Uncle Walter came on. And all these things were staged, and they gave the appearance of reality. They weren't really reality. Nixon had even gone so far as to know where in advance to stand on the Great Wall in China so that he would get the best photogenic shot.
Oh,
yeah, this just taken for granted. Everybody does this. Republicans, Democrats, the others would too. Eddie Clark for the Libertarian Party, if he'd ever had a chance, but he never had a chance, you know, but he got on TV. We're with it. And you have a cast of hundreds of thousands assembled in public squares. And the news was the vehicle. You see, the news was the vehicle by which this amazing possibility presented itself. But suddenly we could see all of this right here and now, and it was really happening. And she said, what happened, and this is really a mind blower here, what happened in the news and what made the television convincing to us in the 1960s were as reality, were the assassinations. The assassination of the 1960s. You can't prove what would have happened if they hadn't happened. We don't know. We only have to, all we can deal with is what we have. She said the two components buttress each other. That is the attractive presidency, the cast of hundreds of thousands. Remember that unbelievable scene when Kennedy was in Berlin and the crowd there, and it's been I'm Berliner, and this is a very powerful moment. Or August 28th, 1963, I Have a Dream, just an incredible scene that Cecil B. DeMille could never have imagined or never have proposed. Suddenly, that is what we decided was reality. Now, here she said something really amazing. She said, just as the assassination would never have occurred without the promise of appearing on television. So think about that for a minute. That really blows your mind, doesn't it? That we might most likely wouldn't have had the assassination if they didn't have the promise of appearing on television. With Oswald, with Ray, with Saran, the three most important assassinations of the 50s. So TV would never have become the final arbiter of American politics without the assassination. I mean, TV has decided, or and television has taken upon itself the role of being the arbitrator of telling us what is true in politics, more than any other of the agencies. I'll just give you one example of this. I wish I had Larry here, because yesterday, and I don't want to argue with somebody who isn't here, but Larry was saying he didn't think television had that much impact. Some of us can remember the national political conventions before the television. Totally different now. Everything in the national political convention is aimed at getting it out, prime time. And remember, they had to turn off Senator Goldwater because he went on and on and on until they lost their prime time, and they withheld the keynote speaker, Vandy Ackler, that is from Michigan, because he was supposed to be the super orator, and they wanted him on prime time. That's what they were paying for. And the whole thing is changed because of television. Television has decided what it's going, what gets news and what doesn't. And remember the enormous competition for who was going to be vice president, and it was Mike Wallace or some crisp who got the final scoop, and that was making news becomes news itself. That was an incredible event. When was it going to be CBS or NBC or ABC who found out first who was going to be the vice president? And it was young Chris Wallace, Mike's son, who worked for NBC, who got the scoop before. Was it Jessica Savage came on first with CBS? But that became the most important thing. Of course, there wasn't much else that went on at the Republican convention that was, a news release. Anyway, with it. But anyway, the assassination, she said, it was like the 68 coronation of Nixon. It was just all, she said, there hasn't been a second ballot for the presidency in the last 24 years. And in 1924, in the Democratic Party, there were 128 ballots for the presidency. That's, times have changed. The who wants to sit and watch ballots being taken over and over again. Television needs instant action all the time. People don't have attention span, so it's all arranged ahead of time. We're with it. We don't have second ballots anyway. We're with it. Sorry. Color, color ads. We're just now beginning to understand. And Emily was talking a little bit yesterday about color, and color was green, with it, and all color has added tremendously to it. We don't know how that works on our unconscious. We simply don't know how color. I mean, precisely, we don't know. We think we know some things because advertisers know that some colors sell products better than other colors. Going way back to Vance Papage, with Hidden Persuaders, why someone found something. Why is it that Pepsi Cola has red, white, and blue? That's not an accident. It's not aesthetically. It's not a very good combination of colors. It really isn't. But it has that all-American quality to it. Northwest Airlines is red, white, and blue. You can go on and on. with the danger of being manipulated, color is so important. Now, anyway, they're back to the assassination thing again. And here she's quoting from Walker Percy, who is a good novelist, a good religious novelist, too. The moviegoer, for instance, if you have your website. And he's saying this in a book called Lancelot. News. What is so important about the news? Ah, I remember. We were wondering who was going to get assassinated next. Sure enough, the next one did get killed. There it was, the sweet, horrid dread we had been waiting for. It was the late 60s, and by then you had gotten used to a certain rhythm of violence, so that one came home with a dread and secret expectation that the pace had quickened, so that when the final act was done, the killing, the news flash. The death watch, the funeral, the killing during the funeral, one watched as one watches a lewd act coming up, dry mouth, lips parted, eyes unblinking and slightly bulging, and even had the sense in oneself of lewdness being played here with it. Or, as McLuhan, the great expert on media, says, Jack Ruby shot Lee Oswald while tightly surrounded by guards who were paralyzed by television cameras. The fascinating and involving power of television scarcely needed this additional proof of its peculiar operation upon human perception. I think it's the first time in my life I've ever seen somebody, instant killing. I mean, we just come home from church and we turn it on and all, golly. And what do you do after that, after you're going to have an assassination, right before your very eyes?
That's right.
I want to comment to that, right. Yeah.
Four more.
And Lenin and the Pope. The Kennedy assassination gave people an immediate sense of the television power to create depth involvement on the one hand, and the numbing effect as deep as grief itself on the other hand. The banal and ritual remark of the conventionally literate that TV presents an experience for the passive viewers is wide of the mark. The guards who failed to protect Oswald were not passive. They were so involved by the mere sight of the TV camera that they lost their sense of their merely practical and specialist task, as I think is an interesting story. So that's why she argues that at the beginning, television takes over from the movies, from the printed media and print media and the rest, because it had the assassination. But it didn't stop there. From the assassinations, we went into the riots for the late 60s. Watts, Newark, Detroit, you remember all of those that happened before your eyes. Sniper shooting at the firemen, trying to come in. All of this happening, turning on. The Chicago Democratic National Convention, did you ever forget? I thought the country was coming apart. I remember, the chanting, the whole world is watching. I really thought the whole, and there it was. Right happening. And I went down a few weeks ago to Balboa on Michigan Boulevard, right where it all was, and, still kind of frightening. Like that. And then the riots led to Vietnam, and, what that did. You remember Morley Schaefer showing the Marines burning down the village, where there were only old women and old men and children, and, what that did was sort of a turning point. And that led to Watergate. All of this televised instantly, instantaneously. The dream, you remember, that Edward R. Murrow had of "You Are There" was now a reality. I mean, Murrow would have these almost fake things in Cronkite, who "You Are There," in the Constitutional Convention, or the death of Socrates, or something like this. Now suddenly you could be there. Owens believes you see the continual telecasting of, for instance, the Watergate hearing involved as many viewers as it did because they hoped that this would be a catharsis, a purging, just as we hoped that by the enormous preoccupation we showed with the Kennedy funeral, that there would be kind of a purging. And I would like to discuss, when I'm done with these remarks, why it was that we had this enormous outburst over the return of the hostages from Iran. It's still there. I mean, that showed us, the yellow ribbons, the whole thing, showed us the impact of television. And that'll tie in a little bit later with it. It's still there. It can be used, and can be used enormously. And then January 20th, what a day. Talk about emotional overload. I mean, the inauguration, and I remember leaving Algiers and the whole thing. And we had a special interest because Bruce Langham is a St. Louis graduate, and all kinds of connections with it. Okay. More evidence on the takeover of television. The 60s saw the booming of television tournament athletics, especially football. Football was live, it was real, and it had instant replay. Football became the ultimate for the American male, just for realizing its potential for ecstasy, for commitment, for fantasy realization. It was all really happening. He wasn't stirred by pictures of the poor, the many, the oppressed, the unjust, or all of that. But he was zapped, as a good television word, by the blitz bomb points put on the board. If you know television jargon, football jargon, you know what that means. Her conclusion is this. In these historical events, the assassinations of the 60s, the attempted assassinations of the 70s, what you see now, I think, gets in here, the riots, the war, Watergate, and football, real life, you see, was wedded to movie life, and it changed our consciousness, our way of perceiving reality. In a way, she argues, we are really becoming the products of our media with us. And it had an enormous impact on our life. It replaced, in many ways, the print media. Look at, for instance, some of the great magazines that folded because of television. Collier folded, the Saturday Evening Post comes back, was it every 3 months now? Folded. Life, remember, I grew up with it. I still remember the first issue of 1937, a picture of Fort Peck Dam in Montana. And so on, and life now comes back every so often, but that went. Look magazine, the Cowell publication went.
Literary
Digest, right. These went, the big general ones went because they couldn't compete for, you know, the advertising dollars with it. But it doesn't mean, you see, and some daily newspapers went. New York City used to have, what was it, 11 dailies. You know, they've got, what, three? Just as one example, Chicago has two, Los Angeles has two. Minneapolis has two, St. Paul has two, but they're owned by the same company, the Cult, and so on. But it does mean that we are, even if anything, more, how should I say this, motivated and stimulated by other kinds of media. We have, for instance, especially the specialized ones, we have bumper stickers everywhere, billboards, posters, records, all of these things still are evidences, you see, that there are ways to motivate us in ways that we didn't have before. Instantaneously, a bumper sticker is instantaneous. Remember I talked about a couple yesterday. Just like television is instantaneous, instead of a long, detailed analysis. We have an instant slogan. Even the New York Times, which used to, you know, all the news that fits the print used to come out, and now I see it's cut back all the time. It's too bad. One day, just for fun, I was on sabbatical at the Union, in New York, and I sat down and I said, I'm going to read everything that's of interest. This is a Monday morning, not the big Sunday time, which takes about 2 weeks to read. But Monday morning, I sat down at 8:30, and at 11 o'clock, I finished reading what I wanted to, you know, in the New York Times for one day. Yeah, here it was, yeah.
I just, you know, as I was writing, I know
it's
one big TV media event that you didn't
Yeah, she mentioned that I crossed it off because I didn't want to go into too much detail on it.
Well, I was just thinking of that one, not to add it to the list, but to add it just because it was comedy.
Yeah, but then what happened was some people with television thought it was all a fake. It was a mock-up. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the astounding things that happened. They couldn't believe this was the case. The first time I remember sitting there, and I said to Helen, is that really the moon? You know, we only had a black and white at that time. Is that really the moon? I just couldn't believe that was the moon, that big white thing, remember, over in the corner. It was impossible that you had a television camera on the moon. Yeah. And Roosevelt and Stalin and Hitler are still living in Argentina. You know, It's fun to talk to people my own age. I mean, my kids don't know when I refer to Roosevelt and Stalin and Hitler, they don't know what I'm talking about.
Well,
God used to use
media for months, and
Helen
used to
put
the show on in Sunday morning.
He
blows, he did at night.
At night, yeah, right, yeah, he learned, right, yeah, absolutely, fine time.
Yeah,
that's good. All right. Now, so what she's saying really is this, and this is kind of heavy stuff. He says that television is creating the way in which now we perceive the world. Real life exists according to our understanding in the way we experience reality as it is shown to us by television. And since television is national, it's international, we don't really, in a sense, believe it's true unless we know that other people are receiving the same pictures, receiving the same information, the same data as we are ourselves. That in a very real sense, what we perceive as reality is that which we share with other people. And there's no longer any sort of private way or personal individualized way of understanding what's going on out there. It's what the television networks and the editors of the news and the rest show us or tell us what's happening with us. And we take our cues from others, yes.
The print media always do the same thing
But there was, yeah, there was more variety. So much more variety with the print media. You knew your conservative newspapers or your liberal newspapers, Sun-Times versus the Trib in Chicago, for instance. Or New York at 11. I mean, that would be the difference. You have the three networks, and there really isn't that much. Maybe CBS is a little bit more liberal. I mean, politically speaking, I think that's true. Walter used to raise his voice rather sharply when he didn't have some of the things that Reagan was doing. I don't know if you picked that up. Yeah.
Well, before we sit down, you can imagine the media from the morning, the media, in the bathtub, the media on the front porch. When watching TV, the experience of sitting there and you are sitting there, millions of other people at that same moment.
Right, yeah. That's what she's exactly the point she's making right with her. And it makes a difference. A perfect example of my campus would be the Kent State, whatever you want to call it, of May 4th, 1970. The next day, we had a full-blown strike of our students because they saw it on television. And, you know, if you know students aren't exactly radical, I mean, it's not Berkeley or something like this, then would you believe that these sons and daughters of these pious Norwegian Lutheran farmers suddenly were on strike? But they had seen it on television. And this was the way the world was. And if they were on strike in Kent State, then they should be on strike on Manitou Heights, which is another like this. Emily?
The difference between television and media is also that the different parts of the brain are affected.
Yeah.
Visual and sensory media.
Yeah.
You have to process your reading through the cortical cortex. The cortex is more private, more difficult, and more central.
Yeah, right. I'll come to that point a little bit different way towards them, but that's so important. And nothing, you've never seen a TV, unless it's really major, like The Assassination or something, usually the maximum length of a story, like a prison riot in Michigan, for instance, take one that just happened, is never more than a minute, maybe a minute and a half. It just has to be done in that sort of a shorter segment of time. With it, okay. With it. Now, all of this has immense all kinds of huge implications, I should say, for Christians. The way she puts it, the implication here is how to avoid being sucked into the media vortex. The way particles of light are drawn irresistibly into the magnetic force field of a black hole. In other words, how can we avoid, how can a Christian being avoid being drawn into doing the same thing and saying that since television is the media, television is what dictates what reality is, that this is the way we then have to meet and address the world itself. And she says the problem is that up until this time, and she means her book as sort of a real manifesto, the problem is that so far Christians have been overjoyed, really, and entirely uncritical of the opportunities that have presented themselves for what you might call advertising or sharing. She uses this. She said if we use God talk, if we sing Him, if we have biblical preaching, then we think we have Christian communication. We think that this is what it takes because those are action things out there going on. Schuller with his hands up in the air, for instance, and the bubbly fountains, something going on all the time with us, and a lot of hymns that we're familiar with, and what we call God talk. And if we hear God talk, then we think it must be religious. And she argues that it isn't necessarily so with us. She says, we shouldn't surrender the capacity of human consciousness to create, to transcend, to criticize the blandishments or the ordinariness of Disneyland in the conglomerate. She argues that the good news just can't be presented authentically on the tube. With us. Now, she argues, why? Well, people will be here, will disagree. We disagreed yesterday on that. So anyway, she says this. TV uses image advertising, and there's a famous theoretician in advertising, his name is Ernest Dichter. And she quotes Dichter on this. Image advertising, and I think a lot of examples will come to mind right away. Image advertising, the best, and this is what Dichter says, the best technique for selling is to paint for the customer a total picture of the kind of person he or she would like to be. Marlboro Man, up here, would be a good example. You get on those jeans and that jean jacket and everything else, and you're a Marlboro Man, and you're out there. Or if you're young, you're Brooke Shields in your designer jeans. All the rest of it. You paint the total picture of the kind of person you like to be, or you're sophisticated Frank Gifford, and you were a proven football player, and now you're sitting down sipping some kind of wine at a fancy dinner party or something else like that. Wouldn't that be great? Instead of, you know, opening a can of Lannenkugel or something, and about all I can afford. That's a local beer, that's the cheapest beer in all right, anyway. Don't bring Erlanders or the others. All right. You paint the kind of picture you would like to be, and then make him believe your product is a necessary part of that picture. See, that's the point. You paint this kind of picture of the kind of person you would like to be, and then make the person believe that the product is a necessary part of that picture. All right? That's what image advertising is all about. As I say, the Marlboro, and you like to be rugged and virile and outdoors and all these things, and all that goes on. And the same thing is, you're an Estee Lauder woman. I mean, let's not only be bipartisan in politics, but you give equal time to men and women on this. You're suddenly an Estee Lauder woman. Or you're Charlie, coming into a bar and bouncing around, you know, and flirting with one man to another, and then finally finding Mr. Wright sitting over in the corner. That's a perfume if you don't know what Charlie is. Okay. And she argues with you that the Christian media have, like the rest of our culture, picked up the same technique. We're called on by the Great Commission to evangelize, we turn to image advertising. And no one planned that religious broadcasting would turn to image advertising, but it has. Our minds were predisposed by image advertising to accept this as the way things, you know, are advertised or are they're sold. And we simply accept image advertising in our religious broadcasting just the way we accept it as a Marlboro man or as an Estee Lauder woman or so many of the other examples that I do get. For instance, today she argues the picture of the Christian is not that of John Bunyan's Pilgrim, which would be a pretty good metaphor, a pretty good image, going through all the difficulties that you find. Pilgrim's Progress is worth reading again. It really is.
Yeah.
John Bunyan, the picture of the Christian is not John Bunyan's Pilgrim, but what do we have as a picture of a real Christian today would be a superstar athlete in a basketball suit, for instance, giving a testimonial, or in a three-piece executive pinstripe suit, or in the clothes, and I hate to keep picking on her, but Tammy Faye Baker on PPL. Who dresses in a way that, you know, well, she has her own way of dressing, let's just put it that way. But it's, you know, it's different. The point is to make the picture of people, you know, a rugged, virile athlete testifying or a successful businessman, politician, John Conley would be the classic example. I mean, he looks like a president. I mean, he always wears a dark blue suit and has white hair and just a little wavy and all the rest of these things. And he's, you know, and a Billy Graham thing, he made his testimony. And so on. He didn't make a testimony about what he did with milk prices, but anyway, you get the idea. You make the picture in image advertising, you see, so appealing that the customer wants to see himself or herself within that frame. Health, wealth, youth, good clothes, optimistic, upbeat optimism all the time is the perfect picture that's portrayed here. All right. Now, this is true not just in television. I don't want to just pick on television, but she said it's true in, for instance, Christian books. Let's give a few more examples. And I spent a lot of time going to Logos. Is that different in Seattle and Portland and other places? Logos bookstores? Is that out here? Yeah. And no, it hasn't. Okay. Of course, Northwestern chain hasn't gotten out here.
Evangel,
is that the one in the Pacific Northwest? But okay. But anyway, you look at the covers on these books. Take, for instance, the books on marriage and sexuality. On the cover, they have a happy, good-looking cover. I mean, a couple, I should say, on the cover. You don't have people who, you know, over 50 and have a pop and a few bulges and a few varicose veins or something. Along with, you have a young, attractive, you know, image advertising kind of couple all the way through this. Or the inspirational books will have a baby, you know, right next to a cup of coffee. They're both nice, warm, friendly kinds of images. Or Billy Graham, they have Cliff Darrell sitting, you know, in a mahogany paneled study with a crackling fire behind him. she points out that if you look at a Beware Scotch ad in the back of Time and Newsweek, it's the same thing, an executive relaxing at home in a mahogany paneled study with a crackling fire behind him. That's an example of success. Obviously, if you drink scotch and not Lannenkugel, you're a success. The point is this. Nowhere in any of this do you find a picture of Christ, except for the movies like Jesus of Nazareth, which I think is a splendid exception to everything I've said. The William Barclay movie that came out 2 years ago, remember? Brilliant, really, and it was so good. With a few exceptions, have you ever seen a picture of Christ on television? No. You don't see this at all. Christ is nowhere to be found in the picture. If you were, it would severely limit the marketing potential, you see, of the program itself. That's a dynamite statement, but I think it's true. If you showed Christ the way we portrayed the many different ones, it would limit the market potential of the program itself. Here's a wonderful comparison. Christ is like Jericho. You don't show Jericho, but you show the picture of somebody who has taken it and is bouncing around with life and energy and happiness. You don't show the medicine itself, but it's like the CV posturpedic morning thing. Just for fun, I take a sample. Who's ever had a CV posturpedic morning? I never have in my life. I've had to bounce out and run around and fly kites and jump over hedges and kiss babies and everything else because I slept well the night before. I've never had, but that's image advertising. That's what we would like. Wouldn't it be fun to have a CV posturpedic morning and bounce out and, But anyway, the picture you see is you said Christ is like Jericho. You don't show Jericho, but the picture of somebody who's taken it and is bouncing around with all this sort of thing. And therefore, image advertising, you see, has taken over with it. What we have, you see, is a whole new phenomenon called Christian entertainment. And Trinity Magazine had a very good article on this called Here's Christian Showbiz. A few years ago. For instance, the religious bookstores are papered with announcements of Christian concerts rather than announcements of Bible studies or small groups of studies or something like that. The assumption here is that the gospel will be more palatable if it is placed in the secularly appealing setting of stage entertainment. There are no advertisements, for instance, for amateur hymn singing. Or a sermon which is delivered by somebody we've never heard of before. But we have announcements, for instance, in this thing called Christian Showbiz, of a really big show with a gay face coming along, all with slick, perfect lighting, sound sets, and everything that goes along with it. This is true also for the, she says, for the Christian record industry, too. Fewer and fewer, quote, homemade lives appear in public. Christians, he argues, are careful to avoid deviations from cultural fashion. The last thing in the world we want to do when we advertise in religious broadcasting is to appear tacky, to appear unrehearsed, to appear somehow, to not project the image of being successful the way the world would want us to be successful, given what we talked about already with image advertising. And here I think is the best quotation of the whole book and one that stayed with me. I've used it over and over and it's so good. She said this, An unbeliever supplied only with a picture of the product that these lifestyle workshops, this entertainment presents, unbeliever with just this picture of image advertising that we talked about, would not have an inkling that the original pattern these people profess to imitate, was a vagrant celibate whose seminar on happiness elevated the morning meek rather than the smiling success. That blew my mind. That what we're really talking about is this vagrant celibate. That's a wonderful way of putting it. And that's what he was a vagrant celibate, whose seminar on happiness elevated the morning meek rather than the smiling success. The morning meek rather than the smiling success. With it. That was an exciting concept that has stayed with me for a long time. All right. She argues to go on that the camera, you see, cannot capture reality. And it is with what the camera cannot hope to capture that the gospel is concerned. As creatures of our culture, we will accept as real only what can be shared, you see, through the electronic extension of our senses. Any data that are not considered significant enough to be fed into that network become for us unreal. This is what I talked about before, about we don't have the shared perception of reality any longer. With it. And it is the reality that flees from the camera that really is what the gospel is all about. The realities of our faith are what the camera can't capture. And the realities would be things like the glory of the cross, the resurrection of the body. the paradoxes, the mysteries, all of these things are not the capable of being placed into the kind of images or the image advertising that we talked about here. What's happening, especially through the media, is that we don't experience faith directly for ourselves, as was done in biblical times. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. We don't experience faith directly for ourselves, as they did, for instance, in biblical times. The Pharisees, the tax collectors, the lepers, the fishermen, they went out to see for themselves at that time. We don't go out to see for ourselves. We don't have to. We have others do it for us and tell us this is what it is when we broadcast it, and we believe that this is what's happening. The God talk, the hymn singing, and all the rest of these things, since this is going on, then we say this is really what the a religious program is all about. All right. And here is really the heart of our argument. The media cannot capture what the essence of religious faith is all about. The realities, or the most profound depths, really, of religious faith. And these, she said, are silence. These are three, really. Silence, hiddenness, and mystery. Silence, hiddenness, and mystery that you find, which the camera is simply incapable of feeling altogether. We don't find, for instance, in the tube, anything like silence, hiddenness, and mystery. If we find it at all in what we might call the artistic or the creative world, they are the works really of the secular artist today rather than of the religious artist. Remember I talked about last time about how the media shrivels up our imagination. Where are the great religious, you know, songs, dances, poems, plays, novels, and so on at the time? For instance, on silence, we are afraid of silence. Perhaps no one is listening, no one is hearing. How can we go know what's going on unless we hear? So we communicate in our society. We communicate vigorously. We're communicating all the time. But what really is it? She argues it's simply distraction. It's distortion. It's the avoidance of anxiety, of boredom, of isolation. Silence, she argues, is the only way of either getting or focusing attention today. All else is a distraction. Silence is so important, and yet silence is something, obviously, that the media, you know, has to avoid at all costs. The same thing is true for her second point, for hiddenness. In our society today, she argues, we fear hiddenness. All experience must be shared. All experience must be related through T groups, through human potential, through sharing. There is a suspicion, really, of privacy. Our private lives are not really private. This accounts for the popularity of things like People magazine. Remember Henry Nouwen did a good study of it with us. Our private lives are not really private. But she argues that hiddenness and privacy, you see, are part of the Christian way. Jesus never advertised. Jesus didn't go around talking about his hangings, nor did his disciples do this. But we do it ourselves. We want everything out there visible, let it all hang out, and we suspect if we don't let it hang out, there's nothing really there. And so we're skeptical, we're suspicious really of hiddenness. The same thing is true with mystery, probably even more so. It is infinitely by our culture, more despised in silence or hiddenness, because it is not suitable material for the media. The media can only produce or reproduce what is out there, the visible and the audible. Yet in the New Testament, mystery is always used with awe and with reverence. Paul said once, what eye has not seen nor ear has heard, as an example of what we're getting at here. So, putting all this together, she suggests that the media, by their very nature, their publicness, their distancing from the source, their standing between us and reality, even the reality of flesh and blood, is what is perverting our reception of grace itself. We simply are no longer really in touch with the deepest, strongest, most satisfying sources of the nourishment, hiddenness, mystery, and the rest that comes from faith itself. The media, she says, may well be the new power of Babel, giving the illusion of access to God or something out of the sharing, but really a distortion. And so her conclusion then is to call on Christians to stand above, to be above the cultural values that surround us itself. The gospel in whatever age finds itself always out of place, finds itself incongruous, extravagant, not pretty, not packageable. It is unmanageable, it is grotesque. And in this age, what that comes back to then is silence, hiddenness, and mystery, as her judgment with it. And then she makes the thing that I talked about last time that you could think about today. Would Christianity have survived if Jesus had been on television or if Paul had a printing press, as an example? So, yeah, we've got a long time for discussion. Right.
I don't understand why not. You know, why if Jesus could talk on television, why wouldn't he be more effective?
Who would sponsor it? I mean, this is total fantasy we're talking here now, but you know, and would you know, like with Emily, would you have to break in with a commercial for Rolaids after 10 minutes? Because people couldn't stand more than 10 minutes of, say, the Sermon on the Mount, or something else like that. You see, what she's asking for is not to pretend that religious experience, in the most profound sense of the word, can be known in anything except what we talked about yesterday, shoulder to shoulder, eyeball to eyeball, personal kinds of experience, and that the media has come in between.
But if Jim Fish was on TV doing his parables, now seemingly, you know, that to me that was very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Now I don't know why I couldn't get that on TV if I happened to see Jim Fish on TV.
Yeah, Beth, anybody want to comment on this? Okay. The problem would be, even the way you talked about this yesterday, are we willing for one thing to pay for it? Either like CBN has done, Christian Broadcasting Network, which is Pat Robertson, but get your own stations where you can do 18 hours a day on cable, or else pay for it in some kind of prime time. And we have decided that would not be what we would want. The market, you see, is too limited for that. It doesn't draw enough people to justify the amount of money which is necessary for it to be the broadcast with it. It's a very practical explanation. Mm-hmm. I would think it would be terrific.
I think that's one of the reasons it's trapped over time.
Because,
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to draw a very amateurish parallel here, but the three-corner evangelist knows that he's not going to appeal to everyone who passes by or even stops to listen to it. He's going on the biblical instruction that he sowed the seed. The Holy Spirit is going to bring about harvest. And I think the church needs to, first of all, say we're going to spend the money. I venture to say that in any of our churches here, if tomorrow you were to ask how many of you sent money to Oral Roberts, how many of you sent money to whatever it happens to be in the electronic religious broadcast today, you find a good number of your people spending that, their money there. And if you were to say, well, we're going to put Jim Fish on, supposing we all know who Jim Fish is and how effective he can be, that they would just as well give their money there. And we forget about the ratings. You see, we are even conditioned by ratings.
Yeah.
See, we watch the shows that the ratings bureaus tell us are the top shows. Whether we want to watch them or not. Okay, we'll forget about the ratings. We'll put Jim Fish on. We'll expect that they only appeal to 1 out of 1,000 people who are watching. But the Holy Spirit will take care of what the harvest is.
Mm-hmm. I think the message that I got from the book, or at least part of which I agree with, is that TV, by its nature, is incapable of presenting the critical part of the message. It's capable only of presenting quick intellectual, short pieces of intellectual insight. You can discuss, you can get the information, but you can't get the human element of it.
Well,
that's what I sense. I sense like the liturgy
Of
the broadcasting divided into two camps, is what I perceive. One is like informational of people like Charles Swindoll or someone that are basically doing Bible study type things. Non-Christians do not listen to that. They're presented on religious stations, and I think there's just a vast minority of people who are unchurched that ever hear that. And so that appeals to Christians as an educational tool. But the other part is, like Kurt said, appeals perhaps to the non-Christian sector, but it's not the message. It's people, it's the flash, it's the well-dressed, it's the you know, strong sexuality. It's all this appealingness that has nothing to do with the Christian message. And I wouldn't be willing to support that financially or otherwise to say that that's the message that I want to present to the world.
Well, one question came up afterwards yesterday, and it sort of is a sequel to what you're talking about here.
about advertising and evangelism for those, for instance, who might not be familiar with or loyal to a particular denomination or tradition. Is it necessary, for instance, to sort of to start where some of the religious broadcasters today start, and then hope that, you know, something will happen from that point on? Are we, in a sense, being elitist by saying that it has to be a full-blown, highly developed, traditional kind of religious worship service that we're showing, such as I mentioned last time, you always get it on Christmas Day from the Episcopalian Church in Washington? Or should we start with something which at least has people watch at the beginning, and then hope that something more can be done? Or does that present the wrong or at least a misleading picture at the beginning, which can never, in a sense, be overcome?
What was that what you were saying? We present whatever we present, and the Holy Spirit will take over.
I would have to go along with that basic philosophy that we do the most effective job of the tools that we have. And I'm the first one to agree with this young lady over here with the type of religious broadcasting that I see today. I just can't watch it. It just makes me squirm. But we're not going to compete with it. We're not going to go that route. We're going to continue to present the gospel in the way that we've always presented it, on the street corners, in the missions, in the churches, wherever it's been presented, in a wholesome, effective way, and let the Holy Spirit do the rest of it. But we're not putting any bucks behind it. Bucks is what it takes in television.
Well, a while back, early in television, Fulton Sheen really had an audience. Now, Fulton Sheen was a preacher,
right?
Right.
By the foolishness of preaching,
right?
And finally,
yes,
he has good following when he's on. And it's again, foolishness of preaching,
right?
Preaching an gospel and holding no punches. Even Billy Graham, there's an awful lot goes around there, but he doesn't have an awful lot more to say than the gospel. I don't find him exciting, and he's not charismatic or anything. You know, he's telling the story. Now, there's a lot of other stuff along with him, the way he does it. But I think that's we're lured away from that because of the sex and the success orientation that religious TV has now. Instead of going right back again to the basics and saying, you know, Sheen was flowering, he was an orator.
Yeah.
And that's maybe the type of thing we needed.
John? John?
Yeah, I think it's a very live question. I mean, I can be saying yes to people in the last 10 minutes, and some of them are saying different things, and I can say yes to both sides, so it is a complicated thing. It seems to me there are two distinct questions. One is whether or not the present electronic church is proclaiming the gospel or not. That one, for me, is easier to have an opinion on. And that one, it seems to me, Lutherans should have the theological ability to separate theology of cross, theology of glory, and everything I've seen in what I call the electronic church is theology of glory.
Yes.
That God is seen best at the time when you're a winner, that Jesus is a success story, and that equating Christian faith with financial success and the elimination of pimples and how to become a homecoming queen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think we can judge that one theologically. The harder question is the electronic media possible as a means of proclaiming the theology of the cross, the gospel as we understand it biblically? How can you present in an electronic media the scandal of Jesus Christ? How do you communicate a scandal electronically? And maybe that's possible, maybe it isn't. I think what happens, and I'm not putting down Fulton Sheen and Billy Graham, Douglas John Hall in his book Light in Our Darkness says, after the lifestyle change, after we really are simpler instead of consumers. After theological orthodoxy, after the last thing that will go of a theology of glory is having the right answers. That's still a theology of glory. And he says what's going to happen is theology of cross people, in order to proclaim the theology of the cross, are going to go around making brilliant speeches about brokenness. And to proclaim the gospel, I really have to stutter. I have to give a broken speech. And it just doesn't sell. So it seems to me the gospel comes, the proclamation of Jesus Christ comes, in the encounter of people in the midst of their brokenness. There are just some ways you cannot communicate that thing.
It's still down at the local church where the off-key organist and the sermon is pretty ordinary, and all the rest is where it happens, instead of the polished performer. Right, I agree with your family wants to get in.
Go ahead.
I have one example of where this was done very successfully when they showed Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
And anybody see that? That was so moving.
Yeah.
They showed the lepers, they showed her there, just as she went about her work. And there was no staging or anything. And the person who did it was actually converted to work in the soup kitchen right after.
Mm-hmm.
That was powerful. Mm-hmm. But that was one enough.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think...
And that's the kind of thing I'm looking for.
I want to agree with Ed. I think there are... I think we ought to find ways. The American Lutheran Church tried with We're Number One. They tried to enter the consciousness of the United States and call into question, from gospel values, this business of always having to be number one.
Right.
Religious Broadcasting Commission of Seattle, with a small budget, tries. They got Excuse Me America on there. They got Ground Zero at Bangor, so they got John Nelson, who protested the Trident with his own life and body over the fence, talk with an admiral who honestly feels that arms build-up is the way to peace, and they let that dialogue come into the homes of them. How can you get hooked, the loving hook of a parable? How can the media do that? Maybe plays, maybe visual images of Mother Teresa, I don't know, but it's worth investigating.
John, to expand a little bit, and this is a piece of personal information that I got from Randy when he was here, about his religious broadcasting group. When he left here, after filming here, he had used up every dollar in his 1980 budget. He had no place to go. He had no more money to spend on the type of work he'd been doing for the last 15 or 20 years. Because the churches who have set up the commission aren't willing to buy the money from the union. And I think that speaks to our lack of concern for the use of what has already proven, as you have said, to be effective. Now, part of that may be due to the fact that the church doesn't know what's been going on. Been an underpublicized, low-key arm of our evangelism. Maybe we need to do a better job of letting people know so the money will come in. But nonetheless, however it has occurred, I spent an hour out there under the tree talking to Grayley, giving him leads where he could go pick up commercial filming opportunities to make some money so he could continue the work that he's been doing. When the church allows that thing to get down to that level, I'm really concerned.
I see with that beautiful statement that sitting, I think, in the dining room. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the schools had all the money to spend, or the churches, and the military had to have a big sale to buy a bomber?
you brought this up, so let me inject this here, because I think what John said was a very succinct summary of the issues. One point that Owens makes is that we've become so conditioned in our unconscious whatever to seeing the news and thinking this is reality, or seeing all the mindless shows that go on and the trash and the junk and all the rest that go on, that we don't really expect anything more from television. And instead of the quality of television, generally speaking, for a wide audience getting better, and it doesn't have to be strictly God talk kind of programming that we're talking about here. You can take Kenneth Clark's Civilization program, for instance, which would be a splendid example of what can be done. Or this one, I don't know if they had it in the Northwest, it was on educational television this winter. What is it, the lights for the new, what was it, Emily, the art and architecture and everything in the 1890s and the early 1900s is a brilliant show. And it can be that kind of thing too. But since television seems to be getting worse and worse in terms of the quality, there are those who argue that one thing churches can do is join in on various kinds of protest movements and coalitions for boycotts and television itself. And this is what she gave me from the U.S. News, Washington newsletter. The war against trash on television is shaping up. The first shot may come in July when the Coalition for Better Television releases the findings of a nationwide poll it conducted to identify sponsors of overly sexually fair. 500,000 forms were mailed to video monitors in all states. The coalition based in Tupelo, Mississippi, threatens to boycott products of firms whose dollars paid for shows deemed offensive. Is that something, we're called on to do, is to organize against that which we disagree with, which in the jargon is called TNA shows or jiggle shows or whatever you want to call them? My favorite would be the Dukes of Hazzard, or my unfavorite, I guess, would be the Duke. Incredible, You really have to suspend belief when you watch that one. It lasted for about 15 minutes for me, but anyway, is that something we're called on to do? To join in with the since television? What is it? The average adult watches, I don't know what children are, adults watches 3 hours a day.
Yeah,
it's
more than that now.
Is it more than that now?
Yeah.
So we're talking about a very real problem.
They paid people in Minneapolis. They offered to pay 30 people to have their TV out of the home for 30 days. What did they offer? $500 or something? And I don't think they got them. And the ones that they did, the psychiatrists checked them, and there were withdrawal symptoms and everything else.
Anybody has any response to this particular suggestion of joining something like the Coalition for Better,
I think that would be a good activist thing to do, but I'd rather think of ways of making really good messages that could be incorporated, so that especially being for children, Bible study things that could be not too entertaining, but so it could compete with some of the cartoons. I don't know. I feel that children watch so much junk, and not only joining against it, but also making something that can compete with it, which would take money, of course.
I don't understand how that coalition can be effective, because if the majority of the people, unfortunately, didn't want that type of programming, would it be there? You can't say, well, why protest if
The argument on the other side of that is that we say that we get the kind of programming that we want, otherwise we wouldn't get it.
Yeah.
But it turns out that there are really just a handful of people. Fred Silverman is always considered, the head guru and all these things, who really decide with us. And we really don't get what we want. We get what the presidents of the programming of the various networks think we want at any given particular time, and that there aren't enough choices really to make to make that much difference,
mm-hmm.
except with some of the educational television ones, and some of that stuff, frankly, is pretty dull with this. So it isn't true that we get what we want. What's happening is that we get what a few people in high places decide that we want. And that, to come back to Owen's point, since we, a perfect example would be shared experience, who killed JR, remember? And that became a thing all over the country. And so we suddenly think that if everybody else is wondering who killed JR, that must be a pretty important question. And I'll give you an example. We were driving in northern Wisconsin. I mean, it was on a Friday night, wasn't it? Yeah, on a Friday night. Dallas was on Friday night. And I didn't care who, you know, who killed J.R., but it was a question, and I'm supposed to study American popular culture, and so on. So I thought I'd better stop. And we're driving, and we're in a little place called Caroline, Wisconsin, up near Green Bay. It's a pretty little town, and so on. And we stopped in for a coffee and something about 9:30 or 10, whatever it was. And I just threw it out, you know, who killed J.R.? And the first reaction of everybody in the restaurant was, you mean you didn't watch? you weren't home watching? That was first. Then they suddenly went, well, people could be out driving. Maybe they had to get somewhere. Something else like this. And then we did have to get someplace by a certain time that night. Anyway, then came all the explanations and the different theories, and the people who were happy with the fact that it was what's her name who did it and not somebody else. This became an enormously important kind of thing, but it was really a media event staged by a couple of really shrewd entrepreneurs, you know, and in charge of the Dallas show.
I guess I'm looking at not at specific shows or types of shows, but trends that we've seen in the last 10 years kind of moving towards really sexually oriented sitcoms like Fantasy Island or Three's Company and so on. And I don't know. I find it really hard to believe that. I admit that probably a few people have a lot of control of the programming, what we see. But if those trends hadn't been something desirable to the American public as a whole, I guess I have a hard time understanding how they would come about.
Well, there are those who argue that it really doesn't matter what comes on. That, you know, the two, you just sort of sit there, and after you have one or two wine and Kugels, it doesn't matter. What comes on, and you're kind of mesmerized by the whole thing. Yeah.
I was just going to make a comment on what Carrie. I thought was asking first, whether a group like this really is effective.
Yeah.
And I happened to listen to Phil Donahue one morning, and he had a representative from either this group or from another one that was sending out questionnaires for people to fill out and saying which programs were offensive to them. And then sending them to the advertising agencies and, you know, talking about boycotting, and they were effective.
I think I saw that same thing, and I guess I think that does say something about it. Mm-hmm. Or I didn't see the same thing, but I have seen like a dialogue between the people from the coalition and people from the programming people, basically. And they're scared. Mm-hmm. They are angry and they're frightened because they're screaming and saying, this is censorship and you have no right to do this. And I don't think they'd be scared if they didn't sense that there was a power there.
Yeah. It says Madison Avenue is wary, not panicky. Trade says sales are strong. The fall TV schedule, it will feature some spicy entries, including a show entitled Washington Mistress. Popular Dallas moves to Friday at 9 on CBS. That's where I saw it. But anyway, so they're wary, but not
They
panicky.
Are paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe the way it would be effective is if, I'm not sure, Brent Silverman is really where the control is. The control perhaps may be where the money is and what sells. If these shows are attractive enough to get people to watch and sell things, then they're going to stay on. On the other hand, maybe, although they're attractive to most people, they're attractive in such a way that people will listen and maybe they'll watch the commercial and they'll be a little moved to buy the product. But if there's enough of us that are strongly moved not to buy the product, I think our smaller numbers can have a greater effect on the advertisers.
Try that again, I'm sorry.
Okay, isn't that what the coalition is doing, is attacking the advertisers for this program?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you going
to? One thing I wanted to say about good, quote, good television is that we're discussing the Reagan economics in another area. One of the areas that Reagan is zeroing in on is the federal support of public television.
Right.
So if we want to do something positive rather than something negative, one positive thing you can do would be write to congressmen and senators and so on and say we're against these cuts. Now that was effective. It was very effective in just the last month when they threatened to make some drastic changes to the Social Security.
Yeah. 96
to 100. That hit Washington like a ton of bricks. There were letters, telegrams by the million. Mm-hmm. So it can be effective. And if you want to save public television, might be a good idea.
It's interesting with a public broadcasting system that if the Reagan cuts go through, it will have less budget money than the annual budget for the Navy and the Marine bands. You start to think of the implications of that. And the answer, that was thrown out to Caspar Weinberger once on Meet the Press or Face the Nation or whatever it was. And he said, well, yes, that's true, but we have to have tradition. In other words, we've always had a Navy and Marine band, and therefore, since we've always had the tradition of a Navy and Marine, I thought that was, it is true, though, that All Things Considered does have a left liberal slant to it. Susan Strasberg and all the rest of them, if you listen to it, and it talks about the arts, it discusses new books on Broadway, new plays, everything. Now, that may well be fine and good for people in Scarsdale, but what about people down in Tupelo, Mississippi? They resent that because there is still very strong suspicion, I think, on the part of a lot of people that there is an intellectual elite who consider themselves superior, who are using the facilities of the media, for instance, simply for themselves, and don't get really down to the gut issues. This is why I think somebody like Jim Baker, with my good old favorite example again, Tammy Faye, catch on. That they suddenly are people who came from poor backgrounds and who have made it big. And people don't mind Jim Baker living in a $250,000 house because they're saying at least one of us did. One of us made good. And that they kind of enjoy the kind of, I would say, straight out tacky level of entertainment that comes along because it's a relief from what they think the Eastern liberal establishment is shoving down their throats by way of the synchronized FM television Metropolitan Opera broadcasts and all the rest. And I think there is an enormous backlash which has its outlet in various kinds of neoconservative movements which are showing up today, and a lot of people are happy to get rid of public broadcasting or All Things Considered would be the example. Because it's telling them that they are inferior, that they're less educated, and that they aren't they're considered less important than other people. And the best example in politics would be George Wallace, and and he knew his base of support, what I call the politics of resentment. Remember, Wallace, we're going to get all those bureaucrats in Washington, and we're going to take all those briefcases, and we're going to throw them in the Potomac. And we're going to get all those pointy-headed people, in other words, professors, what did he say? Ride bicycles, smoke pipes, and wear berets. Well, when you put that together, you know exactly who you're talking about. And he didn't say corduroy suit with a turtleneck sweater, but that's the uniform. But he didn't have to wear this. Tremendous support. And that's where so much of what I call the new Christian right is getting its support. Today, gun control would be a good example of that. The anti-gun control sentiment is coming, and which makes me agree with Owens that I'm a little suspicious, as much as I think we should keep trying, that the kind of religious broadcasting that we're talking about, to come back to the original theme, is really going to be that effective unless we're willing to take the chances and get away from the numbers game. Maybe with cable. Maybe there's hope with cable, because cable can do very specialized things that can get away from the domination and the monopoly of the three networks.
With the satellite origination of things, we're in with all different.
Yeah, it's going to be. Yeah.
Control is going to be different now.
Yeah.
I also say that my concern about with the way that religious programming is right now, that we're compromising our basic beliefs in order to get numbers.
Yes.
And that's not what the basic Christian message is, and that really bothers me that's what we have to feel we must resort to.
So many numbers per dollar invested.
Or we used to have something, or you go the other way about compromising beliefs, not talking about anything controversial. You used to do it the other way. I don't think it's still on, called Religious Town Hall of the Air. Was that just a local or a Twin City program? Does that ring a bell with any?
Yeah.
Okay. But then what they were saying is we're going to have stage confrontation. We're deliberately going to have a Jew, a Catholic, a liberal, a conservative, all these things. And it doesn't really matter what they say, because we're being tolerant and open-minded by letting them all go at it. You don't have to pay any attention to this, because after all, we expect these people to have differences of opinion, and we're going to sit there and be generous and open-minded for half an hour and listen to these things. And we can sit back and pat ourselves on the back and say, now we have presented different viewpoints. Well, you've already, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You've already told the audience ahead of time that there are going to be differences, and you really don't have to make up, change your mind on the basis of anything, that you can pick out your person that you like who's saying what you want to hear. And these other people are obviously going to disagree with them, and you simply appeal to the, you know, stereotypic thinking rather than ask them to listen carefully. As John was mentioning the example of the person with pride and actually having an honest dialogue with the admiral, that would be admirable in the other sense of the word, admirable. I'm got mixed up on my syntax there. Go ahead.
You mentioned the cut in government funding of public TV, though. Instead of asking the government to get back in there, could we use this as an opportunity for us to get in there as a church or as individuals to have more say about public TV? You know,
both, because
they're down now, and they're going to be looking for money. They're going to be, you know, I hate to be materialistic about it, but we sort of got them in a public TV. We have them in a position where they're going to be willing to do things for our money. Can we now get in there and maybe put some of our kind of programming on there, or just as individuals or as a church?
Not most, but the public television that I have been accustomed to watching is very receptive to the people that support it. In fact, Channel 9 in Seattle and the other satellites around there do a tremendous job of canvassing their supporters, the people who send them the $10 or more, to find out. They'll send a list of programs. Yeah. Say, do you want to listen to this?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to
they
not
do that
listen to this? Or if you don't want to, what is it you want? Mm-hmm. So they are receptive, and maybe that's the direction you
know. Mm-hmm. We can solve that problem by sending 20 instead of 10.
It is true.
As far as I looked at the figures, that would work. You know, there's the foundation, there's the individuals, there's the government. If the government's out, the individuals don't, solves that problem.
Mm-hmm.